All right, so today we are continuing our summer sermon series in Exodus. We finally actually get two Sundays in a row in this series after having a little bit of a intermingling with the last sermon series, kind of every other Sunday for a little while there. This series is called Journey to Freedom as we go through, we're not going through every verse in Exodus. That would be probably a two-year series. But we're getting the big picture overview and looking at some of the significant themes in Exodus and help you to understand it more. And so this Journey to Freedom topic is appropriate to the book of Exodus, also appropriate to, of course, we had the 4th of July just recently, last Sunday, and the freedom we have thanks to the vaccine for those of us who've been vaccinated, including here in worship. And I'll tell you, it is so great to be here without a mask. I was talking with Brooke just before the service, and actually she initiated the conversation. She tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Dad, it feels so weird to be in church and not have a mask on." And I'm like, "Yeah, it does feel kind of odd." So I missed that last week with you all. My family was up on Orcas Island. We were camping at Moran State Park, and we went to church. Gwen and I did. The kids didn't make out of bed on time, but we went to the early service at the little Episcopal church there in East Sound, the main town on Orcas Island. There were maybe 20 people in church. Like, I think it was more like 18. I mean, when I say small church, it was a small church. Beautiful, right on the water. I thought they did a terrible job of taking advantage of that with their sanctuary. The front of the sanctuary, like we have here, it was all wall, just like ours is. And I'm like, right on the other side is Puget Sound. I would have built that thing differently. But we were blessed to be there, and it was great. Maybe it'd be distracting. I don't know. Maybe it's a good thing they don't have it that way. But it was a blessing to be there, and now it's a blessing to be back in church with all of you here as well. So today we're continuing the series in Exodus, as I said. And in today's passage, we're going to see a leap in the timeline of Moses' life. So we're going to dive into Exodus chapter 2, beginning in verse 11 through 22. And it starts right off with kind of a big time skip from where we were last week. We'll talk about that here in a moment. So this is God's word to you and me today. "One day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, 'Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?' The man said, 'Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?' Then Moses was afraid and thought, 'What I did must have become known.' When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now a priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered their flock. When the girls returned to Reuel, their father, he asked them, 'Why have you returned so early today?' They answered, 'An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock.' 'And where is he?' Reuel asked his daughters. 'Why did you leave him? Invite him to have something to eat.' Moses agreed to stay with the man, who gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, 'I have become a foreigner in a foreign land.'" All right, so we began here in verse 11. As I said, it covers, in just a few words, a huge span of time when we read these words. "One day after Moses had grown up." We don't know exactly how long that was, but in the verses just prior to this, Moses was still a baby. And then we get to the events after verse 11. Clearly, he's not a baby anymore. He is definitely grown up. Maybe his late teens, maybe more like his early 20s. Something like that. But there's a sense in which he'd grown up that seems to be more than just physical or chronological. Moses has grown up in the sense of being, of realizing and being aware of the plight of his people, his blood relatives, the Hebrews. As we heard last week, Moses grew up as Egyptian royalty. as an adopted son. And his flesh and blood people were the Hebrews, also known as the Israelites. But this was not likely the first time he had ever gone out and watched them doing their hard labor. In fact, the Hebrew words for went out and watched are in the imperfect form, giving the sense that this is, although it's in the past, it was an ongoing thing, like a regular thing that he did, an ongoing thing. And you may recall from chapter 1, as Paul preached, 3 weeks ago, I think it was, on the opening chapter of this, that the Egyptians watched or treated the Hebrews ruthlessly. We also see in chapter 1, in verses 11 through 14, it says that they were oppressed by the Egyptians. They were treated as slaves with slave masters over them. Their lives were made bitter and forced, and with forced and harsh labor. You see, all those words describe how they were treated. So Moses had to have seen all of that. Like, he knew that was going on. He was well aware of how the Egyptians treated the Hebrews. And yet this time, when he goes out, something snaps. There's a response that wasn't there before. And you kind of wonder, why had he not acted like this before? Why had he not stood up for this? Had his own ease and the palace lifestyle that he had, did it blind him to what was going on? Or did it cause him to just kind of think, well, this isn't my problem. That's for somebody else to figure out. That's just their dilemma, those poor people. Certainly the Egyptian version of the historical narrative and the narrative of what was happening right in front of them, not just historically speaking, but in the moment, the Egyptian version of that is what was ingrained in him. He grew up in Egyptian royalty household. Maybe he even blamed the Hebrews for their plight. This is so easy for us to do, to dismiss or overlook the challenges that other people face, to have a little bit of an air of superiority without even thinking about it or realizing it. Maybe even contributing to their plight and their situation without understanding our role in it. Let me give you just kind of a lighthearted example that doesn't go nearly as far as what we read here. And by no means do I mean to say this is on equal footing with it at all. But it helps us to understand that we can all, I think, kind of get caught up in a little bit of like an air of superiority. And I think this makes it accessible for us. So in my household growing up, we cheered for the University of Washington. My parents graduated from there. Both of them did. One of my grandmothers graduated from the UW. It's just who we rooted for. It's where I went, as you all know, and graduated from as well. And the narrative for me growing up, it was never spoken like this, but kind of like the underlying current of things, was that the UW was superior to all other universities, with even a little bit of like, why would you even go somewhere else? It's just, that's where you go. That's what you're going to do. None of those things were actually spoken that way, but it was just kind of there. The attitude was there. And a lot of it really was lighthearted college rivalry, particularly on the football field, kind of fun. So it started with the athletics, but it kind of spilled over into academics. And I know that kind of thing is common. Like, we could go around, any of us who went to another university, you'd probably say, my university is the best, that's where you should go. So it's all fun and games, even though it's, if it's actually true for us Huskies, right? So, see, even I've bit hook, line, and sinker for it myself. But at some point, we do all grow up. We all grow up, as Moses did. And so while we may still root for a particular university, and we cheer them on in the athletics, and maybe support them financially or who knows, we recognize that there are valid reasons to attend other schools. It's okay to go to university somewhere else because and recognize that those are real people also created in God's image who are going there for good reasons. So we learn to differentiate between the institution of the other, okay, which we might, you know, in that academic or university athletic sense, we might root against or even mock, and you see it in professional sports, of course, and get regional rivalries, you know, Washington versus Oregon, Seattleites versus Portland folks. You know, you get that kind of stuff going on. But we can differentiate between that institution stuff and the individual of the other, who we can befriend and love even though they are part of that rival organization. That's why a cougar can marry a husky. At my last church, there was a gal who had graduated, I think she graduated from UCLA, and he graduated from USC, or maybe it's the other way around. And they had this sticker on the refrigerator that said, a house divided. And it was like half in UCLA colors and half in USC colors. You can do that. You can marry and befriend people and still root against their institution when it comes to, say, the Apple Cup or whatever the rivalry games are and that kind of thing. We've got this in our family. My son Blake is a freshman at SPU this year. It's great. I love that school. It does help that it's a local school because I love all things Seattle and the region, of course. It also helps that they don't compete against the UW athletically, usually. Haley, my daughter, is going into her senior year in high school this fall. She's starting to look at colleges and universities. She had an online tour. She's done a few of them, but she had one this week, an online tour and like introduction to the University of Southern California this week. I had to gulp, kind of bite my tongue, say, it's okay. You can explore that school. It's all right. And if you choose to go there, I'll disown you, but that's your choice, and that's just the consequences. I'm kidding. I have grown up. If she goes there, it's all right. You see, we tend to think of this kind of air of superiority towards others as something that only other people struggle with. But we can fall to it even, you know, in that kind of example. It's all fun and games. You know, it's just university or regional rivalry kind of things. So it's fun at those kinds of allegiances, but it gets downright serious and problematic in other spheres of life, such as nationality or politics or skin color or gender or age or race, any other element of being human that we tend to use to divide is not a good thing to engage in. The fact is, regardless of those things that are different about us, we're all humans. We're human. We are created in God's image. Each person on the face of the planet is someone who Jesus loves and went to the cross for. And this division and sense of superiority or inferiority, whichever side of the coin you may be on, it can become a part of who we are at the very core. And as we hear and live the narrative of us and them, or us versus them in the worst situations, and we always live it from the us perspective, right? And you can't help that. You are who you are. The people you've grown up with and the people you're around with, you're going to hear that narrative from that perspective. But unfortunately, this tendency to listen to just one side of the story has led to serious damage and sin throughout history and around the globe by non-Christians and by Christians. And we're still not out of the woods by any means. So Moses grew up hearing the wealthy, powerful, royal family Egyptian version of things and undoubtedly justified the Egyptian treatment of the Hebrews. That's just what he heard. Like, that's just the way things are. But something in him on this occasion snapped. When he went out, his sense of injustice and that this is simply wrong overtook him, overwhelmed him. Now, this is not to say that the response that he carried out is justified. Murder should not be considered as an option in any response like this. That is a big topic. It's a topic for another message another day. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a part of a plot to assassinate Hitler. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer, if you don't know, he's a Christian pastor and theologian in Germany at that time. Ended up being killed in the Nazi prison camp because the plot was found out. But he was part of a plot to assassinate Hitler as a pastor. So that's a complex issue. They felt the death of one was better than the death of millions in the Holocaust. That's a big topic. Generally speaking, though, murder should be off the table. What we see, though, is that Moses finally has grown up and realized the pain of his own people. He saw things from their perspective rather than the perspective he'd always viewed them from. And even though his reaction might not have been morally proper, he was moved in that moment to stand up for justice, to stand up for this person who was being beaten. He's like, that ain't right. And he took matters into his hands. He did something. He didn't let history or tradition or what he'd been taught or apathy. He didn't let that stop him from taking action. And quite frankly, I would suggest to you, we need more Moses types in our world. We need more Christians, mature Christians, Christians who have grown up, who are willing to do something about the injustices of the world. Jesus himself said, "Whatever you've done for the least of these, you've done for me." Who are the least of these? Jesus goes on to tell us. He says that they are the hungry, the thirsty, the sick, the poor, the people who are in prison, and the stranger and the foreigner. The word for stranger there in that verse is xenos, and it is the root for our word xenophobia, which is the fear of the foreigner, and that leads to all kinds of walls being put up in division. So Jesus implores us in this parable to welcome the xenos, to welcome the foreigner, to welcome the stranger. So when I say we need more people in our world who are Moses types, what I really mean are we need people who are more Christ-like, we need Christians who are Christ-like, who have the humility to listen to the historical and the present narrative from the viewpoint of those who have been marginalized. To understand their worldview, to understand where they're coming from, and then stand up for them. Champion their cause. Come alongside them to welcome them, not put them out. We'll come back to that in a little bit here. Let's keep going through the passage some here. The next day, Moses enters into another situation that could have gotten very ugly very fast. This time it's between two Hebrew guys. And rather than responding in violence, Moses used his words. That's one of Gwen's and my favorite phrases with our kids when they're tempted to respond in a physical kind of way. We've done this for years from the time they were little. Use your words. Use your words. Use your words. Don't use your hands or your elbows or your feet. Use your words. So we get the sense that while he still has a heart for justice, he has very quickly realized that the way he went about fighting injustice just the day before was not right. And there's a better way. And so he uses his words. And then through that conversation with these guys, he realizes that what he'd done the previous day was not done in secret, as he probably thought it was. In fact, word gets to Pharaoh, who tries to kill him. But Moses flees. He flees to a region called Midian. This is now in verse 15. Scholars believe that Midian, it's not a region that exists today, as you probably know. You've never heard of it, right, other than in Scripture. Believe it was on the northeast, so I'm going to try to do this for you guys from your perspective. If this is the Red Sea, it's in the northeast, like, tip of the Red Sea. In present-day Arabia, it would be like northwest Arabia. If you know where the Suez Canal is, and if you didn't before 2 months ago when the Ever Given got stuck there, you certainly know now where the Suez Canal is. It's like due east 200 miles and then down south maybe like 100, something like that, 50 miles. That's the region where Midian was. And there, Moses encounters yet another case of someone being wronged. This time, it's a handful of girls or young women who are sisters and who are harassed by some shepherds as they tried to get their flock while they're watching for their father. Probably sheep. This doesn't actually tell us, though. So Moses steps in and helps them to get water from the well to water their flock. Presumably this time, he takes care of things without killing anybody. Like, the lesson is still learned. Apparently, the gals suffer from this kind of harassment regularly because their father, his name is Reuel. Later on, we know him also as Jethro. He notes that they have returned home earlier than they usually do from watering their flock. In other words, they normally have the same harassment from the other shepherds that they got this time when Moses intervened. They normally have that same experience, and they're made to go to the back of the line, even though maybe they were there first, and they've got to wait to water their flock. And they end up taking a lot longer as a result. And that's the usual routine, because today, all of a sudden, they're home earlier, and he notices, hey, this isn't when you usually get home. What happened? So Moses made sure that they got their water in the order in which they had arrived there at the well. We're told here that Reuel is a priest. He's a religious leader, which might make us wonder, at least I wonder, like, what's the religion A priest of what? Like, what's going on here? What god or gods did they worship? Well, the Midianites get their name from their ancestor, Midian, who was a son of, does anybody know? Abraham. He was a son of Abraham. So the Midianites traced their lineage back to the same guy that the Hebrews did, the Hebrews who were in Egypt, ancestors of Moses, which means their religion gets its roots there as well. In other words, they worship the same God as the Hebrews did. Now, it is possible that the Midianites had intermingled with others, and there was some maybe some worship of others that came in with it. We see that in the Old Testament with the Israelites. It happens quite frequently. Moses was born Hebrew but grew up in an Egyptian household. He probably had some mixture going on in his life. I mean, just being honest, reality is, right? But nonetheless, they've got this common ancestry and common faith tradition that they both know the name Yahweh and worship him on some level. So when they saw each other, like, they were able to join in and sing the song. I think I've used this in a sermon before too, but it just bears, you got to sing it. This is what they said. Father Abraham had many kids had Father Abraham, and I am one of them, says Moses, and so are you. So let's just praise the Lord. I mean, they were able to sing that song together. They never even knew each other till now. They've got Father Abraham in common. So Moses sticks around and ends up marrying Zipporah, one of Reuel's daughters. They have a son. They name him Gershom. For those of you with kids, right now you're thinking, my goodness, I wish we'd read this when we were bearing children. We could have named one of our kids Gershom. And if you're done having kids, it's such a good name, you're going to reconsider not having any more kids. Just to have one and name them Gershom, right? No? I'm seeing heads shake. Okay, maybe not. But for Moses, it's a meaningful name. Sounds kind of funny to us. A lot of biblical names do. But for Moses, it's a meaningful name because it sounds very similar to the Hebrew word for foreigner. And Moses has essentially been a foreigner his entire life. His entire life, he's been a foreigner. So there are a couple of things, I think, to take away from this passage. And I already touched on one of them. We're going to return to it briefly. And then there's a second thing I want to highlight for us. Each of our perspectives on the world has been completely shaped by the people that we are surrounded with. From the time you're growing up all the way through to right now. Your family, your friends, the culture in which you find yourselves, cultural influences, and so forth. And I want to ask this question. Is it possible, like Moses, somehow God got through to Moses. Is it possible, like Moses, that viewing the world from a different perspective might help you see the world, actually see it more clearly, and therefore help you live your faith in a way that connects more deeply with the people around you? I'm going to guess, you know, we're in an evangelical Presbyterian church. And so there's certain things about that are a part of our church. It doesn't mean that everyone always subscribes to everything, of course. There might be particulars about our church that some of you disagree with, and that's okay. We got to agree on the essentials. But one of the things that is generally the culture of an evangelical Presbyterian church is that we want other people to know Jesus. We want people who are far from God to come near to him through faith in Jesus Christ. And one of the ways that you can minister to others in your lives or connect with them and help them get connected to Jesus is to understand the world from their perspective, to hear their story, to understand what makes them tick. Why are they the way that they are? How do they view the world? So listen to them. Get to know people. Look for opportunities then to share your faith in a way that will connect with who they are. Someone recently reminded me of a quote that says, don't judge someone until you've walked a mile in their shoes. And we can do that. We can walk a mile in people's shoes just by being in conversation and listening to them. Or reading books and articles that come from a different perspective than what we might typically have. Or listening to music that comes from different cultures. Viewing art that comes from a different culture. Seeking to understand people's perspectives as best as possible. I shared with you all a couple years ago about a year before that, I had started listening to rap and hip-hop music, and I clarified for you that it was Christian rap and hip-hop. I can't go to the secular stuff. This is too negative. But Christian rap and hip-hop music I started getting into. Part of my motivation was to understand a whole different culture. I wanted to get my mind around what it's like to be Christian and not